heard about all the wonderful work that the rabbi is doing in the school to really bring it to the next level and the next and the next. And yes, it is funny that when this is my first time in Brazil, and when you're not somewhere, you hear about it, you know a little bit about it, I hear Brazil here and there, but like I have no comprehension of what it is. And what's impressive to me is literally I got here and we're from the same community, a lot of people here come from the same background as we do, and within an hour of getting off the plane, I felt very much at home. Most of the community here is Syrian, a lot of it's Syrian, partly Syrian. In this room, mostly Syrian. So we don't discriminate against other people, like we're okay with them too, right? Good. So everyone's invited. I'm saying we like even people that are non-Syrians, but it feels at home a little bit that way. And that's really how we have it back in New York, in the Syrian community in New York. And now I think I've had the opportunity to visit all of the Syrian communities. I've been in the Syrian community in Mexico and in Panama many times. And of course, New York and New Jersey. And now to be here. I had no idea Brazil has 200 million people in it. I thought you'd like Argentina, like the rabbi said. How many people are in Argentina? Like 50 million? 20 million? 50. And like Panama?
22.
2. So Panama is like your kid's sister, like Hazaton. Yes?
It's a neighborhood.
It's a neighborhood, got it. Okay, here's what we're going to talk about today. I hope you like me before this, because I'm not sure you're going to like me after I say what I'm about to say. I want to tell you something about your kid's future. It will have in it disappointment, a lot. It will have in it moments that they're frustrated. It'll have in it times that they'll wake up in the morning not even sure why they chose this person as their husband or this woman as their wife. They'll have days that the pressure is so extreme that they'll go to sleep at night not even sure why they want to get up, what they're looking forward to the next morning. They'll have days that they wake up in the morning with a pit in their stomach because of all the things that they have to go through that day. They're going to have in their lifetime extreme failures. Sometimes ones that people will know about, and sometimes ones people don't know about. They'll have many, many days of anxiety, some days of frustration and depression. And no, I didn't come here to Brazil to tell you something negative about your children. But everything I just said is the reality of every single person's life. There's almost no one that is spared from what I just described. Almost every person I've ever met has moments of extreme anxiety and frustration, days that the pressure is so extreme, days that they wake up in the morning with a pit in their stomach, they're not sure how they're going to get through the day, days that they're disappointed about decisions they made, and moments that their failure seems epic and embarrassingly so. Every single person has this in their future. And that's a good life. Which means our responsibility, besides spending a tremendous amount of time on our children, spending amount of time with our children, and money on our children, besides all of the love we have to give them, and all the understanding we have to have for them, all of those things are critical and real. But maybe more than anything else, we need to prepare them. We need to prepare them for the world that they're about to enter into. And prepare them for what real life actually looks like. And real life is so much more difficult, especially if you're unprepared. The Ramchal writes that Olam Hazeh, this world that we're put in, is a world that has Amal Vatorach. It has a tremendous amount of work and labor. He says, and Yetzer Hara, and temptations and frustration. When Hashem told Adam HaRishon, Bezi'at Apecha Toch Alechem, with the sweat of your brow, you will eat. That meant that is going to be a part of every single person's lives. Now let me explain to you the problem. Here's the problem. We live in 2025, and almost every single thing about our world today is better than it was 100 years ago. Think about it. 100 years ago, you didn't have an oven just to put your food on ready to go. 100 years ago, you didn't have air conditioning in your house. 100 years ago, you maybe didn't even have a restroom in your house. 100 years ago, you didn't have a microwave that you could just press. Maybe you don't even have to press and just talk to and tell it, heat up my food. You didn't have a phone in your pocket. I don't know, again, I asked the boys inside, or some of them, you ever heard of this thing that used to have this back in the day? When I was a kid, there was this thing called a library. You ever heard of a library? It was a place you'd go if you didn't know information and you're curious. Let's say you lived in New York and you're curious, what's up with this place called Brazil? You go walk to the library, maybe you'll be 5-6 blocks away from your house. You go ask the librarian, can you tell me a little bit about Brazil? And she'll say, yeah, we have these books. All of them were like old and ancient and boring. And you'd open up the book and you start to research Brazil. And after a while, you'd have an idea of where it is and how many people. Now, where's Brazil? Boom, boom. Brazil, 200 million people. There's South America. Boom, biggest country. Done. You can see anywhere in the world as it's happening. You can access anywhere in the world at any time. You can communicate with anyone in the world as it's taking place. You can, a soldier could enter into Gaza and you could watch his tefillah literally 3 minutes after he does it. And if you would like, you could watch it as he's doing it. Your life, there are cars that barely have a steering wheel left to them. I don't know if you know, in LA, they have Ubers that don't have drivers. Don't have a driver. You press Uber, you want it to come to your house, a car pulls up to your house on the street, not a train or anything, a car comes right up to your house, and you walk, sit in the seat, and there's no driver, and it takes you where you need to go. Everything is easier. You remember there was a thing called film? It was film. That meant you took a picture, and then you had to take the film and go to the store and develop the film and get the picture 3 days later. Do you remember this? There used to be a thing called a store. That would be a place where you went shopping. You went into the store and you'd buy things. Today, your wife sits in bed, clicks 3 things, and the boxes show up. Do they show up in Brazil with a smile also? Yes? She's happy, you're crying, and that's the box. But there's one thing that we are missing today that we had 100 years ago, easily, simply assumed that today it's not exactly so. Of all the things that are better today than they were 100 years ago, this one thing is not. And that is that today we're in an age where hard work is not a thing. Hard work, to really work hard. I don't know what it was like here in COVID, but I know what it was like in New York. COVID came, everyone worked at home. Then COVID ended. I don't feel comfortable going to the office. I'll come in for 2 days, pay me for 5. This went on for years. People were wearing masks just as a fraud to enable themselves to stay home more. Again, I'm in the Syrian community in Brooklyn. It's a successful, affluent community. There's a thing in the community for years that, you know, men in their 60s or 70s, in the summertime, we have cold weather most of the year. The summertime, when it's nice weather, they go to their summer homes. And there would be older men that don't work on Fridays. I remember that growing up. Now go to any 20-year-old in the street, say, you go to work on Friday? They're like, what, me on Friday? I'd be like, you're 20 years old. I said, nah, I work on Friday. One second. Your grandfather doesn't work on Fridays. He went, when he was 20 years old, he went to the Orient. He stayed there for 6 months at a time. He slept on the floor in a hotel in Bangladesh. There was no restroom, barely any food. They ate tuna out of a can. He did it for 6 months. He called your grandma twice out of those 6 months to get back to home. And then he came back home and he worked 14-hour days for 40 years. And then he started taking off on Fridays. You're 20 years old, you've got nothing done in your life. Nah, I don't work on Fridays. Me. Gemara says these words. Amar Rav l'Rav Kahana. Netosh nevelta b'shuka. Skin. A dead animal in the marketplace. Ushkol agra and get paid. Velo tema gavra rabba ana. Don't say, I am too important. Vezila b'milta. And it's too degrading for me. What was Rav telling Rav Kahana? Rav was telling Rav Kahana is that if that's what it takes, skin a dead animal in the marketplace. Skinning a dead animal is A, filthy. It's messy, it's bloody, it's filthy. B, it's a horrible odor, a horrible smell. And C, it's in public. It's the last thing anyone would want to do. But you know what Rav is telling Rav Kahana? If that's what it takes, work. There's a beauty to work. So here we are raising our children, and there's no better feeling for a father than when a kid comes and says, can we go somewhere? And the father says, you know what? Thank God we could do it. Yeah, we'll go. Mom, Dad, can I have that? Baruch Hashem, yeah, no problem. Easy, here's the card. Here's the phone. Go order it. It's a great feeling. It's a great feeling to be able to say, I can do that. Yeah, you need that car, I can get it for you. You want to go on away on vacation? Can't do this week, but in 2 weeks from now, we're going to do it. It's a great feeling. But all of a sudden, we're taking them on vacations, buying them cars, getting them stuff, and we're giving them a great time when they're 16 years old. But we're not preparing them for being 36 years old. And all of a sudden, we have a generation of people that don't understand that hard work is a thing. In fact, it's not just a thing. It's a fact. That means just like gravity is a fact, if I pick this up and drop it down, I'm not sure if I should, it might break, but if I pick it up and drop it down, the gravity is going to fall. Space is a fact. That means I can't be here and in New York at the same time. It's just a fact of life. Time is a fact. It can't be Tuesday and Wednesday at the same time. It's a fact. Hard work is also a fact. I don't know anybody, I've yet to meet a person that has achieved anything of substance without an intense amount of work. Intense amount of work. That means there's no marriage I've ever seen that was great if it didn't have a lot of work and sacrifice to go there. I've never seen a family of kids that the kids are phenomenal kids and it just happened by itself. I've never seen a business that has been extremely successful just because there was good momentum. Maybe people had a good month because of good momentum. Maybe people were able to sell gloves or sanitizers during COVID because they had a good month without any hard work. But a real substantial business over time takes a lot of hard work every single time. In fact, a few people here mentioned Mr. Esses, or close to back in New York, Mr. Eddie Esses. We were working on a project. And he and I were working on a project, something for the community. And in the beginning, it was easy. And I was like, wow, this might be the first time in my life that I'm doing something important, and it's easy. And you know what happened? Within a week, it became incredibly hard. Now I said, you know what? Now it has a chance of making. Because that's the law. Just like gravity is a law, and space is a law, and time is a law, hard work is a law of life. No one has ever built a Torah family without hard work. No one's ever become a Ben Torah without hard work. Everything requires hard work. No one's ever built a great reputation without hard work. So our responsibility as fathers, as much as it is to love them and care about them and kiss them and hug them and be there for them and provide for them, and it's a great feeling to provide for them. But sometimes we don't realize the side effect of all that we're giving our kids is they forget what it takes to get it. And they think it happens by itself. Do you think a kid ever thinks about the fact that running water in your house requires a bill to be paid? Do you think they ever think that the air conditioning when it's on has to be paid? Do you think they even stop and really realize that tuition is something that is paid? They think these are parts of life. And then all of a sudden, they have to do it themselves, and they don't really know what it looks like and what it is. So if we're going to be healthy parents, and we're going to give our kids all the love and understanding and time and money and all those things we're going to give to them, we also have to give them this pill called preparedness. Preparedness means put them in a position where they do have to earn it. Maybe you want to give them a nice vacation because that's what you want to do for your family, but maybe the next one in some way has to be earned. Maybe when they do, when they're put in the wrong seat in school and they say they can't see the board, you tell them, you know what? Life isn't going to always be fair in 20 years from now, so figure out how to see behind the tall kid in front of you. Because that's how life works. When a kid takes a test and fails, don't call the school and say, could you modify my kid's next test? Let the kid take the test and figure out how to work hard. I had a day where one of my daughters was hysterical crying. One of our midterms was so intensely hard. And I'll be honest with you, I felt like, what is the school crazy? Like, why are they backbreaking labor for this test? But you know what? I felt great that she had to do it. In fact, I'll give you a little story and tell me what you would do. In our house, we don't like to do sleepovers. That means, let's say, one kid sleeps over by a friend's house. Do you like that? You know what I'm talking about? In your house, do you do this? You let it or you don't let it? You're comfortable with it? Everyone in Brazil is comfortable with it? Some yes, some no. So in our house, we don't do it. That's not a New York thing. Plenty of people do it. But in our house, we like to not have our kids just sleep over by someone else's house, whatever. Now, a few months ago, if some of you know me well, you know this, my 25-year-old son had a stroke. And it was a very intense thing, especially the first month after. We were very involved back and forth to hospitals. And one day I get a call from one of my teenage daughters. She's in 10th grade. And she said, Dad, all my friends, they're having a sleepover. And I want to go. And you have to let me go. And I'm sure going to go. I'm sitting in the car. I have no time to deal with this. I'm not in the mood to deal with this. I'm like, well, we don't do sleepovers. But like, what's the reason? And to be honest with you, in that moment, I didn't even remember the reason. You know, like sometimes you have a rule in the house, you're not even sure why. So what would you do at that moment? What would you do? What would you do? Well, I got no answer. Okay, answer. What would you do? Let? Just go. I agree. That's what I would have done too. But she had already spoke to my wife, and my wife really said no. Now it's a whole other story. Yeah, I got it. Now we don't even count. I got it. Once the wife made a decision. But I felt like, you know what? There's nothing wrong with her feeling like she can't go because this is our family standard and we don't do it. And even though she's going to cry, sometimes my daughter's allowed to cry. Now, it happens to be that there was a later time that I let her do it once. But that night I felt like it wasn't necessary. It didn't even make sense. And it's okay to hear the word no. Because getting past the no is how life is. You don't get yeses to everything. I need to know that life is real. But what we have right now is we have a generation of people that are getting celebrated for achievements that are barely any achievement. It barely even accomplished anything. And they're already able to, again, I don't know if anyone, was a celebration like in soccer 40 years ago? If someone scored a goal, any soccer fans in this room? Brazil's in bad shape. What? Everybody's a soccer fan. Okay, so I'll tell you what we used to have. There's this sport in America called football. It's funny because they don't use their foot. They use their arms. But it's called football. And the way football is, you've heard of football in America? Good. In American football, the way it used to be is 40 years ago, if someone threw a touchdown, guy scored a touchdown. After he scored the touchdown, that kind of was his job. He would hand the ball to the referee and say, I scored a touchdown. That was it. Nowadays, guy scores a touchdown, even if his team is losing by 20 points, which is a lot in American football. Team is losing by 20 points. He'll do a whole dance and a whole celebration. Now he gets 12 other players on his team. They do a whole Broadway play in the end zone because they scored one touchdown. It all of a sudden became a society that, like, you're a big deal. You didn't even do anything yet. And you think you're a big deal. You scored a touchdown in the NFL. That's what you get paid for. What are we celebrating? But we have to make our kids feel like they're the best. And we have to validate everything they do. They didn't achieve anything yet. And we're already making them feel like they're the greatest things in the world. The other night, we had a little basketball tournament in my shul. A little Shabbat tournament, fathers and sons, whatever. So my son asked me, Dad, can I go to the tournament, play in the tournament? I said, yeah, okay, play in the tournament. He's 10 years old. He's cute. He's my son, youngest. Yeah, you can play in the tournament. And I wasn't there. I wasn't making a speech, whoever I was. And I comes on that night. He says, "Dad, I got a trophy."
"Really?"
"Yeah, big, huge trophy. I see a trophy literally from the floor to like here." I said, "Oh, wow." I said, "You got a trophy like that just for like a Saturday night tournament for 1 hour?" I said, "Did you win?" He says, "No." I said, "So how'd you get the trophy?" He says, "Someone else won. They didn't want the trophy, so I took it home." I said, "That's how it works. You go into my son's room right now, you'll see his big trophy on his dresser, as if he won like the NBA Finals. And he played basketball on a Saturday night and lost and got a trophy. That's what it feels like right now for kids in this generation. They want a trophy for getting through 10th, 6th grade. They feel like they're the greatest thing in the world, that they have an average that's a little above others. No, 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 this is how life is. You need to work and work hard. You don't just get a trophy just for showing up. The hard work is part of how it's supposed to be." Let me give you another little mashal, and I give it inside. In fact, you know, we first a little thought. Yaakov Avinu, when he was born, he got this interesting name. Yaakov means the heel. When Esau was born, he got an interesting name. Because he was full of hair already, he got a name Esav, which means Asui. Why is this Esav's name and this Yaakov's name? The answer is because of this point we just made. Esav is the danger of the world. You know what the danger of the world is? They're Asui. They think they're done when they were born. Look, he's all red. He has all hair. He's like a grown-up already. He's done. Yaakov Avinu, on the other hand, the Jewish nation, how we've gotten to where we are, is that we understand you have to start from the akev, you have to start from the heel, from the bottom up. You have to work and work and work and work to get there. I told the boys inside, this is a true story. My first shiurim I used to give was 25 years ago. I gave a shiur, it was one night a week. I was living in Lakewood, New Jersey. The shiur was in Deal, New Jersey, which was a half hour away. I would travel a half hour, give a shiur for 45 minutes that had 6 to 8 people around the table. I'm not exaggerating. 6 to 8 people around the table. I would prepare for 10 hours and didn't get paid. And I did this for months and months. Didn't get paid a dollar. Traveled a half hour back and forth. Gave the shiur to 6 or 7, 8 or 8 people. And prepared for 10 hours. I want to tell you about it. Besides the fact that Lashem Shamayim and spreading Torah, it was probably the best business decision I ever made in my life. Business decision. Because by working and preparing and honing your craft and practicing on a small group, and you can get feedback again and again and again, week after week after week after month after year, you get better. You know, there was once a show. People, you have Netflix in the house? Okay. You ever hear this show called My Unorthodox Life? One person heard of it, two people heard of it. Heard of it. Yeah. So what's the story? The story is of a woman. Oh, you saw it? Oh, yeah. Oh, who said I saw it?
I saw the first episode and I refused to watch
anything
further.
Good, I'm proud of you. The rabbi's proud of you too. Good, good, good decision. So let me tell you, I never saw any of it. I didn't see the trailer, I didn't see any part of it. What this show is about, it's about a religious woman who grew up in Muncie, New York, which is a very religious atmosphere, you know, she covers her hair and all the whole fully, whatever. And then she completely gave it up. She became like not Jewish. She married a non-Jewish man, left her husband, left her kids behind, married a non-Jewish man. She dresses however she wants to dress, completely couldn't care less of any concept of modesty in the world. She started her own business, she's married to a billionaire, she's wow. And this is her life, my unorthodox life. And this show was a season one, was all about her incredible life. So again, in the Simi community, I think it came out in 2021, a few women, people came over to me and said, "Rabbi, what do you have to say about this show? Look how great her life is." So again, I didn't see the show or even the trailer for the show, but I read an article about the show. And in the article, they show you a picture of her life before, and they show you pretty much, you know, how the media works. Her life before, they picked the worst day of her life. Like, she looked like she's wearing a bag over her head in the rain. And then they meant the picture now, and her life is incredible. Rabbi, what do you have to say? Look how great her life is. her unorthodox non-Jewish life is how great it is. I said, I want to tell you something, how life works. And I actually made a speech out of this that summer. I said, Hashem makes two paths in front of us. The path of blessing is a path that starts off with thorns and then has beautiful pasture after. The other path starts off with green pasture and a beautiful path, and then it's miles of thorns. And Hashem says to every Jew, you have a choice. The path of blessing or the path of curse. The path of blessing always starts off with thorns. It always starts off difficult. And then after you get through the thorns, you see beautiful pasture. The other path, the path of Kelalah, always starts off easy. It's always simple in the beginning. And then in the end, it's a mess. I said, you know what? I'm so happy for her. I said, I want to tell you this truth. If I made a show called My Alcohol Life, season one would also be phenomenal. You know what season one would look like? You see me with a bottle of thing, dancing on a table, as happy as could be. But by season 10, I'd be sick as a dog. If you made a show called My Gambling Life, you'd see me in some casino that he bells and whistles, $10,000 hand, $20,000 hand. They'd be sending me limos to pick me up, to put me in suites for free. You'd see my life would be unbelievable. But by season 10, I'd be broke. My drug life, oh, season one would be the best. I'd be chilled, happy. By season 10, the main actor would be dead. I said, I'm so happy for her. She's having the most fun now. Get back to me on season 10. Let's see what her life looks like 10 years from now. Of course the beginning is easy. Of course the beginning is a ton of fun. You left religion, you could eat on kosher, you could do whatever you want, dress whatever you want, go wherever you want, say whatever you want, be whatever you want, do whatever you want. It's always easy in the beginning. That's how the path of Biracha, of Kilala is. But let's see what happens in the end. I was in a school back then called Magen David Yeshiva. It's very similar to this one in Brooklyn, New York. And I used to teach a girls' class 5 periods a week. 1 period on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then 2 periods on Thursday. So the way we did is I did the subject Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And the second period on Thursday was question and answers. They could ask anything they want. One girl raised her hand and said, Rabbi, what do you have to say about this show? And I gave her this whole answer that I just told you right now. I gave this whole answer that I just told you right now. So I said, let's see season 10. 2 months later, one of the girls walks into the room and said, Rabbi, you don't have to wait till season 10. I said, what do you mean, what happened? I said, oh, she lost her business. Her husband divorced her. Her life is a complete mess. I don't think they even made season 2. Because that's how it works. The path of Kilala is always easy in the beginning. It's always fun to start. Drugs are fun. Alcohol is fun. Gambling is fun. Seeing the craziest thing on the internet is fun. Not working hard is also chilling and fun. But the result is, 10 years down the road, you're going to pay a price. But if you're willing to train our children how to walk through the thorns initially, if we're willing to train our children how to take some scars and endure some failure and take a punch and still get back up, if we're willing to train our children to be able to work hard, even if not all their friends are, in order to earn things, even though you could afford to give it to them without. If we could train our children to have this work ethic, then we could prepare them for whatever life is. And what happens is that one day when life is a little frustrating or a little anxious and does require more work than they expected, or life does have pressure in it, they'll be able to deal with it. I want to tell you my proudest moment. One of my proudest moments as a father was the day my son got his stroke. It was also the most difficult day as a father, seeing my 25-year-old son who has 2 children, who was numb on half his body, has no feeling in half his body, and he still barely has feeling on the left side of his body. He got a stroke on the right part of the brain, and it affects the left side of the body. You know what I was proud of? His willingness to put in the work right away. Dad, what is it going to take? how much therapy do I need to do? How much vision therapy? How much gross motor skills? How much fine motor skills? What do I need? Where do I need to move? Which rehab do I have to be in? How do I wake up early to do it? And in fact, the other day, my daughter-in-law, his wife, told me, "Dad, why don't you go work out with my son, with Michael, our son, your son?" I said, "You know what? I'm going to work out with Michael." And now, I don't really work out. You know, you work out here? Is that a thing you do? You work out? Do you work out? You don't work out? Means you exercise? You do. Oh, you do? Okay, good. So my son says, "Okay, now I'm figuring it can't be that hard. If he had a stroke, whatever he could do, I could for sure do." He started doing this thing called lunges. You know what a lunge is? Here's what a lunge is. You do like this. That's a lunge. He does 40 of them every day. I tried to do 40 of them. I couldn't walk for a week. I couldn't. I was like, "One second, you had a stroke. You do this every day?" He says, "Yeah, that's what it takes." That's what you want to hear from your children. Yes, there's a lot of fun of putting your kids on a plane and know you're going on a vacation, or hand your son a key, a set of keys for a new, or whatever we use today, for a new car. It's a lot of fun. But there's much more rewarding is to prepare them for the life ahead and train them to be able to endure some of those thorns, so that one day they can appreciate the joy and satisfaction that comes from building something with your bare hands, that comes from building a marriage and building a business and building a family and building a reputation with your hard, hard work. There's so much joy and satisfaction. And if you're willing and ready, then when the pressure comes, it's not so hard. And when the anxiety comes, it's not so difficult. And when there's a project that entails climbing, so to speak, a mountain, it's not so hard to do because they're prepared for it. So you have a choice. Which path you want to put your kid on? You can give them joy today and sacrifice tomorrow. Or every now and then, you can train them to sacrifice today for joy tomorrow. Thank you.